Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Debbie.
Hey, Debbie.
Hi, Debbie.
For those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with a serenity prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the purpose of the meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not liable to any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open, big book self-study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. And tonight we are on the second half of step one, and we have Brad and Robert here from Virginia Beach, and we're going to be letting them introduce themselves here in just a minute. We're going to start with reading from the big book, and now I have to switch over here to step one. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. We're going to start kind of in on page 5 in Bill's story with the paragraph that starts, I woke up, this had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective, seeing near being just that. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. Some time passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I have what it takes. One day, I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time, I was leaning on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then, and I did. And I think we'll let Brad start, and then Robert.
My name's Brad. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date, January 28th, 2000, and my home group is West Ghent, Wednesday nights, right down the street on Princess Anne and Lee. Anyway, so tonight we are talking about the mind of the alcoholic, and I want to do a little preface because tell you a little bit about my story, because my first approach to AA was in 1988, and what I know now was that I basically got to AA on the mania of alcoholism, and what I mean by that is I was a full-blown alcoholic, but I had never even considered quitting. You know, it was just when a person drinks the way I drank, life is going to fall apart, and that's what was happening. I was 22 when I got to AA in 1988, and everything in my life was swirling the drain. I was, you know, the job I had, I walked out of because it interfered with my drinking. I totaled the vehicle that I was driving. I was not welcome back in college that I just attended, and I was getting ready to get evicted from the place I lived, and I reached out for help, and I'd had some exposure to AA because I had two family members that were currently at that time sober, so I knew a little bit about AA. You know, I actually used to take my sister to meetings, but so you know, I got to AA, and I hadn't experienced this even an attempt to quit drinking. My only strategies up to that point were kind of, I'd used different methodologies to stay away from drinking, just to avoid trouble. Because by the time I was 22, my drinking caused problems, and so I would try other outside issues, kind of ways to stay away from the drink. But the truth of the matter was, is whatever else I was trying, just it didn't do for me what booze did for me, and so I'd always end up back on it. And so I'm gonna talk a little bit more about this mind that can't seem to let it go, the whole thing with drinking, as we go on. So I'm gonna pass right now.
Thanks, Brad. My name is Robert. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Robert.
My sobriety age is January 2nd, 2005. My home group's Uptown Young and Sober on Wednesday. It's 7:30. And that's on Tucson and Princess Anne Road. I guess a little bit about me. I also came in Alcoholics Anonymous at the right time, I'd say. I really wanted to change my life for the better, or just actually, to be honest with you, just stop the pain. I was just talking to somebody before the meeting. I still have the same truck, still the same job, still the same family, most of my friends. So that stuff was consistent. As a matter of fact, all those people really wanted me to stop. I didn't particularly want to stop drinking. I just wanted to get, you know, the pain to stop. But I was losing my mind. I was in the midst of a very heavy alcoholic psychosis. I had extreme highs, extreme lows. That went on about 5-6 times a day. You know, if you're an alcoholic, you might be able to relate a little bit to that. And that was very demanding lifestyle. I drank. That was my number one thing. I started a little bit late for people like us at 18. I decided to try something different when I was 32. Or actually, technically 31, because my birthday is January 15th. So, yeah, 31. Powerlessness. Do I comment on this part right now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. I know nothing about recovery or AA. My family history does not have recovery in it. So I was like sort of like the very first true attempt at that. My uncle did a little bit of something, but that was to get away from some people, so we're not going to really talk about him. So I did experience this, believe it or not. Coming towards the end of my drinking, about 6 months, maybe 7 months before I came into AA, even I started to realize that I might have a problem. I started to drink even more than I usually drank, which is quite a bit. And I woke up one day, and it was dark and cold. I did not know where I was. I worked third shift, still work third shift. So it's not unusual for me to be bombed out of my mind by 9 o'clock in the morning. So I woke up, it was cold, it was dark. I had no idea where I was or how long I was out, which is not unusual. I was pretty much a blackout drinker coming towards the end. And I'm looking around, I felt it. I'm like, oh, man, where am I? I'm like, oh, it's probably a hospital because it's really cold. Hospitals are always cold when I'm in a hospital. I thought around. It was really pitch black. And I felt around, I'm like, oh, there's a toilet. I'm like, ooh, maybe it's not a hospital. So long story short is I open up these double doors, and I realize that I'm in my sister's master bathroom. It's bright and sunny out, and I have no idea how long I've been there. And I know I'm probably going to get in trouble. I honestly don't like to get in trouble. I cause trouble, and trouble always finds me, but I honestly don't like the repercussions of trouble. Trouble's actually kind of fun, but I just don't want to clean up the mess afterwards. So I looked in the mirror after that. I opened the door. I'm like, oh, wow. Checked on the dogs and made sure they were still in the house. Go back to the mirror with the sunlight of the spirit, or sunlight beaming in through these double doors in this bathroom. And I look in the mirror, and it was difficult to recognize myself, to be honest with you. And I said, man, something's got to stop. And that started my attempt, like Brad was saying, many different ways and formulas to go ahead and control or stop my drinking altogether. All were failures. Until I was dared to go to AA. And yeah, and then you guys got a hold of me and worked a few simple actions, plug the home group here, or a few simple steps, and all of a sudden that started to change. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you. We're going to continue on page 7. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 to 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. But it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. She would soon have to give me over to the undertaker or the asylum.
Okay. Well, where I left off, I just spoke. So I got sober when I was 22, and I came to AA, and it took me a while to finally get a sponsor and take some steps. But it was probably about 3 or 4 years in it, but I did. I ended up basically suffering untreated alcoholism without drinking, and I got all the rewards of that. And which propelled me into asking someone to take me through the steps, and I did that, and I got relief. And what I did was I started having wonderful things happen in my life. And so what a person like me does is enjoy those and forget the methodology that got me there. And I slowly drifted from AA And I had this thought. This thought started surfacing. This idea. This that, you know what, Brad? Maybe you were 22 when you got here. Maybe it was just a youthful thing. Maybe all your friends seem to drink like that. Maybe it was just. Maybe you're making a big deal. Maybe you made a mistake for these 9 years. Maybe you've made a mistake, and maybe you can drink. And here's the other thing, Brad. This is the dialogue. Is if we run into a little trouble, we know where AA is. We'll just trot on right back over there, and we'll just get saddled back up and get sober again. Sounds good to me, Brad. and eventually that thought, that obsessive thought, and I had mountains of evidence. In these dialogues in my head, I would go, oh my gosh, but what about this, and this? But this is, tonight we're talking about the mind of an alcoholic and the idea that I've got a mind that's always going to take me back to drinking, whether it's, 2 weeks, 2 days, 2 years, 9 years. If I'm not seeking God, if I'm not seeking a spiritual solution, and I'm trying to combat my alcoholism with whatever means, I'm just heading towards a drink, and that's what happened. So I ended up talking myself into a drink, and that's when I got to experience the joys, because I, in short order of picking up that drink again, I realized that what you guys had been talking about, the progressive nature of this disease, was true too, which I quietly kept to myself that I thought was nonsense. That, wow, 9 years I picked up a drink, and holy moly am I drinking like a maniac. And I mean, the allergy was off the charts. And so my experiment was, yeah, wow, I'm in deep quick. And but in this, I'd forgotten AA, you know, I'd forgotten a lot of AA, and I was just, my instinct is to, I know what I need to do. And so that's when the journey of trying to quit, to stay stopped, because I actually, you know, I had a wife at the time, I'll put that in quotes, you know, the conversations got heavy quick, and I started doing the stuff, swearing off, you know, and just I couldn't help myself, and you know, that's I had to do that for basically 2 years. I'd love to tell you that I walked back into AA after, you know, surrendering, hitting bottom, whatever it was, but that wasn't what happened. You know, I ended up in AA because I got intervened on and put in a rehab, and eventually, you know, in the middle of this, there was I had that a moment of clarity, and I said, you know what, I can't do this. You know, I really can't, and I need AA, and that's what got me back to, you know, January 28th, 2000. So,
guys, thanks for sharing, Brad. This reading, amazingly, how weakened we become when come back from liquor, but often remain strong in other respects. I related to that. The obsession to drink. Well, it was just that, obsession, a compulsion. I'm a big fan of music, listen to music all the time, did back then, still do today. I get, you guys taught me to be honest, open-minded, and willing, and music was so huge in my early recovery. Matter of fact, I felt I had to make an amends to my nephew, who was around me a lot, and my sister, because if I obsess about something, if I like it, I like it a lot. So there was like two or three songs on my stereo for literally the first year. One was Willing by Little Feet. Maybe not a great recovery song if you ever listen to the song, but I wasn't really taking the main portion of that song. The dude was beat up from the feet up, and he was willing to do whatever it took. In the song, he was looking for other things. For me, I was looking for a different way of life, and I had to be willing to do that. I mention all of this because there is a song that the Bare Naked Ladies sang. And most of the time I don't read, I just speak from the heart, but my memory is really bad because they said we might have wet brain. I didn't have wet brain, but my brain was soaked in alcohol. Like, I still have short-term memory problems. People think I play it up, and I don't. I just have a really bad memory. But back then, you could have a conversation with me, and if you've been around drunks, you'll have the same conversation with that drunk in like 5 minutes, and they think it's brand new. It's like Nemo from... the fish from Nemo are like, hey, what's your name? I still ask people what their name is, right? So long story short is I didn't want to read because this really sums up my the obsession thing for me. It's from the Bare Naked Ladies. Brian Wilson says, caught impulsive, caught compulsive, caught insane. But when I'm surrounded, I just can't stop. It's a matter of instinct. It's a matter of condition. It's a matter of fact. You can call me Pavlov's dog, ring a bell, and I salivate. How do you like that? That really summarizes my obsession with alcohol. When I was in the midst of alcoholism, active alcoholism, there was no stopping that. The obsession was the number one thing. I drank. Now, I still have the same job. So you're like, well, you didn't drink all the time. No, you're right. I didn't drink on the job. I used other party favors. But the only reason I drank was, the only reason I worked was to support my drinking and actually my family. But drinking was right up there. The girls and mom had to be taken care of, but after that, it was game on for me. I did my job as a man. I took care of my family. The rest was all me. I was very selfish that way. And so the obsession was right there. being strong in other aspects. I'm not sure about you guys. I think we're resilient people. It's amazing what I've drugged myself through, put myself through to go ahead in order to get what I thought I needed. And at the time, I think my body really did need alcohol. I don't know. I'm not God. But I'll tell you what, if I didn't have alcohol, you did not want to be around me. The longest I stayed sober before coming to AA was 30 days. I lost a bet in the bowling alley during right at Lent. And everybody was, a lot of people were concerned about my drinking. They said, if you lose, and I was on a winning streak, so I'm like, I'm going to definitely win this game, and they're going to give me more booze, so I'm a winner. I lost that game, which was ridiculous. And they said I had to stop drinking for 30 days. After 10 days of not drinking on that bet, everybody that wanted me to stop drinking told me to drink. The obsession was there. I just didn't have the physical stuff in my body, which I personally think my body needed at that time. And obsession, wow. I'm glad that there's steps in this program to alleviate that obsession. You'd think I would know when the obsession to drink was lifted. I do not. One of the most major things in my life, it went away. It went away from me by working the steps with another alcoholic and listening to other people other than myself. I love what Brad said about that dialogue. Brad, is this a good idea? No, Brad. No other Brad. Yes, other Brad. Oh, I've done that many, many times. Still today. And when I start to do that more than twice, I call somebody. I like the fact that it's a we program and not a me or an I program. It's very heavy. And the book straight from Jump Street says, We of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's huge for me. The steps are designed to living, and it does take away this obsession. You can almost say it gives a sufficient substitute, which it did for me, which now I'm kind of obsessed with, which in a healthier way, which is good. So it's progress, not perfection. I'm only a 10. I act like a 10. That's all you get. It's just me. Thanks for letting me share.
All right, we're going to move on to page 24. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove.
Well, yeah, choice. I have lost the power of choice in her. Yes, I guess I was one of those people that was under the illusion that I chose every drink. That was until I started choosing to not drink and found that the other part of me was choosing to drink too. So, that part of me would generally win out. So, you know, this idea of choice, power, you know. It lost. I don't know where that line was. It seemed like, you know, I started drinking at 12, and it was fun. It was a lot of fun through teenage, even in the troubling times. The payoff for booze was very high. You know, I could handle scrapes and, you know, little run-ins with the law and all that kind of stuff. It just did so much for me, man. But you know, when I drank again after being in AA, it was a different animal. You know, I got to experience that soul sickening drinking and choosing, attempting to choose not to drink. You know, I was just like, I'm not drinking today. I'm not drinking today. I always use a metaphor of every day I was not drinking. I was just, it was like a rubber band just being stretched. I'm not drinking today. I'm not drinking today. And then it eventually just snapped back. You know, I couldn't even tell you. I couldn't give you an excuse. You know, sometimes I would muster one up. I'd tell you, you know, blah, 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 blah. But, I just end up with the drink back in my hand again. And my wife at the time coming home and just seeing me with that wine bottle, because we all know wine's good for you, right? It's good for the heart. That was I wasn't a wine drinker until this last time. I heard that two glasses of wine, well, maybe two bottles of wine is probably really good for your heart. No, not at all. But yeah, my willpower was, it was non-existent. You know, it was existent for hours, and then it was, and I knew, you know, I had that AA experience before, so I knew that a person like me has no business drinking. So it wasn't, I'm just going to quit for the weekend, or I need to quit for a week. I was legitimately, I need to quit drinking for good and all. And I just couldn't pull it off. And I was trying my best, coming up with my best strategies and, you know, to lick this thing. And I just found time and time again, boom. Drunk.
Thanks, bro. This part, I have to make a correction. I didn't intentionally lie to you. I said the longest I've been without drinking was that bowling alley bet. That is incorrect. It just dawned on me while reading this, or I've been read to. Longest I went without drinking was right before I came into AA. It says on the other page, jails or institutions or asylums and stuff like that. I never experienced any of that. The last time I did drink and do some other stuff, apparently breathing is essential. If you stop breathing, then your body just kind of dies. And if you're lucky or fortunate enough, they resuscitate you. That was my story. Out of three, I picked the permanent one, I guess. way to go. Go big or go home. But... This was a very powerful part of the book for me. I like when we're reading the book, and if we're fortunate enough to be around for a little while, you get to see two sides of yourself, possibly. I don't know about you guys, but I got to see two sides of myself. As I stayed away from the alcohol, things started to change. I started getting a different perspective, and I got that from other people and clearly the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I will say this part rang very true to me. I didn't drink starting January 2nd. January 1st, I was probably still drinking because when they resuscitated me, it was like 3 o'clock in the morning, so whatever. But January 2nd, I did not put any substances into my body whatsoever, definitely not alcohol. And February 5th, the Philadelphia Eagles were in the Super Bowl, so that's kind of a big deal if you're from Philadelphia. Hell, I don't even like, heck, I didn't even like the team, but I wanted to be there because I'm pretty sure they're going to burn the city down. That's going to be an epic party. So I go to my friend, who was my higher power at the time, I realized. And I said, friend, how much should I drink so I go ahead and, you know, don't get in trouble? And she said, it was less than 30 days ago, or 30, whatever, 33 days ago, whatever, semantics, that they had to resuscitate you. I'm like, yeah, but that was 33 days ago. That was a long time ago. Clearly, I don't have a problem. I haven't been drinking for this long. There is not a problem. I find that is pretty unique to people possibly like us, that you have a major event go on and you're like, oh, that was nothing. That was like last month. That was a year ago. So I relate to that. Yeah, put your hand on a hot stove. Yeah, it hurt, but like Brad was saying, oh, there's a payoff. That's that obsession. Is the juice worth the squeeze? You know, am I going to eat glass? But after the end of this, is this going to be good? And if the question is yes, then I'm going to do that. Unfortunately, that was the way I was wired. I think AA is a game changer in perspective for me, where you guys, once again, give me a sufficient substitute. I need a substitute to what's going on with me. I got an obsession of the mind. I definitely got an allergy of body. If there is nothing that is going to substitute that, then I'm in big trouble. Big trouble. And luckily, there was a book that was written and people that are willing to give it away. And if I stick with that solution so far just for today, I did not have to go ahead and do more research yet. I don't take my sobriety for granted. I do believe it's a one day at a time thing. My life is good. Your substitute, Brad, was commenting on this is good. And that has been my experience. It's been getting better slowly over time. As long as I'm willing to do the work, you guys keep on giving me enough to make it. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you.
And we're going to move on to page 34. For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. We are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. Many of us felt that we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it, this utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. How then shall we help our readers determine to their own satisfaction whether they are one of us? The experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we can render an even greater service to alcoholic sufferers and perhaps to the medical fraternity. So we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking, for obviously this is the crux of the problem. What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree, which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy, are mystified when he walks directly into a saloon. Why does he? Of what is he thinking?
So here we are back to asking the reader if they really want to stop. And I could answer yes to that when I came back in. And but this non-spiritual, whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual depends upon the extent to which he's already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. That's powerful stuff there. You know, I certainly was trying. I was truly trying spiritual and non-spiritual means, and found it didn't work. Obviously, some of my attempts were, you know, of the variety of like getting healthy, hitting the gym, running, dedicating myself more to my job, since I'm obviously not giving them 100%. You know, I'm not even in the clear till, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and you know, maybe I need to work on my relationship more, give more to my partner, and I was also at the time that of this two some year relapse, I was involved in a spiritual group, and I would, you know, I was attempting to reignite my meditation practice, and it didn't work. None of those worked for me to keep me away from that drink. And I love that. What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic? You know, I was the I can tell you what dominated the my mind was me. You know, thoughts about me. And when I think about me, I'm not one of those people that thinks, you know, I'm wonderful and I'm brilliant and it's just about life is not treating me right. My boss doesn't appreciate me. My partner doesn't appreciate me. You know, I'm not making, you know, everything. It's a rubber band, man. I think like that. It's just, I need relief. And, you know, and what the excuse at the end of that that dominated thought was varied from day to day, but I didn't have an excuse, or, you know, I wasn't selling myself. Well, this time you can drink like a gentleman. There wasn't that. It was just I need to pull the ripcord. You know, I need relief. I don't care. I'll pay the piper. Wherever this takes me, I'll deal with that when it comes. But I need sweet relief now. And this sobriety, this life without drinking, is tough going, you know. And that showed up in all kinds of different ways. But that was the essence of my life, living on a non-spiritual basis. And the results were horrible. It was just the results were drunkenness and profound suffering.
Thanks, Brad. I also like this reading. Actually, I like the whole book, so let's just get that off the table so I can stop repeating myself again. I think it was really well written. I think it spoke to me in varying degrees of ways. And the more I read it and the more I go along this journey, it changes. It morphs in. It's very organic to me. It's mentioned that it's a living program, and that's been very true for me. There's been a lot of times where some of the things that I read a little while ago. Didn't really make sense. I knew it was a tool, so I kept it in the toolbox, but I didn't use it. Then more is revealed, so I'm like, oh, wow, shiny tool. Let's take this out. I like this. I like what Brad had to say because he's really kind of telling my story just from his mouth. One thing that I would say about what I was really riddled with, and I didn't even know, there was a conscious part of me. If you had a pie graph, I'm a visual dude, so if you had a pie graph, I would say I'm looking at 25, max 30% consciousness, and then the rest is completely unconscious. And that varies. It just keeps getting lower with the consciousness when I'm drinking. I go into blackout. It doesn't mean I fall asleep quietly into the night. It means that I'm walking around like a living zombie, not knowing what I'm doing. When I'm in the midst of it, very hard to realize what I'm doing. I like step four. Step four for me was a huge thing. It wasn't very big and scary, at least the way it was presented to me. It was very loving. It was very eye-opening. Most of my resentments, a matter of fact, almost my whole entire life, it pops to me. When I realized I was an alcoholic, it was like somebody opening up those double doors in the bathroom. There's light on the other side of this life that I was living. Step four was very much like that. I always consider AA Roto-Rooter for me. here's me. All of this is God. And there's a conduit for me. And that conduit's full of junk. And most of it's fear-ridden. And it's clogging up the conduit from me to my higher power. These steps, these tools, will go ahead and clear that pipe out nice and clean. The sunlight of the Spirit comes through me. And, wow, I didn't even know there was a life worth living. That's what the program really does for me. It gets me in contact with something greater than myself, which diminishes or totally relieves, depending on the day or the moment, this fear, this selfishness, this self-centeredness, this obsession of not just with drinking. That's our number one priority. I got it, you know. But if you take away that in the first step, or if that's a leap from me, I'm still an obsessive dude. I'm still living. I still got this brain between my legs. I need help on a daily basis, and these tools are made for somebody like me to go ahead. And I love what you said about working out. I come into AA. Okay, what am I going to do? I'm going to get another job. I'll work two jobs, work really hard to keep myself busy, and I actually kind of needed that. I couldn't sleep for the first, like, year and a half. It was pretty bad. But working out, I'll work out. I'll get healthy. I'll get super healthy. I became obsessed with getting super healthy, which in turn blew out my shoulder and I became super weak. So I think balance is a really good thing for somebody like me. I will go from one obsession to another obsession without the tools of recovery in my life. Then I'm just substituting once again, maybe a little healthier than what I was, but still nonetheless obsessing. I would like to be relieved of that obsession of self, be relieved from that fear. I don't get that magically. I get that through living the program of AA. And once again, not alone. And probably could talk more, but I'll just go ahead and stop. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you. All right, we're on page 37. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? You may think this is an extreme case. To us, it is not far-fetched, for this kind of thinking has been characteristic of every single one of us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences, but there was always the curious mental phenomenon that, parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea won out. Next day, we would ask ourselves in all earnestness and sincerity how it could have happened.
This whole talk about insanity, I was, when I first got to AA, I heard it was said in here that the insanity you guys were talking about was the insanity of taking that first drink. But I somehow lumped, you know, Cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs in there, and I had to learn that this is what we are talking about. We're not talking about Freudian or Jungian insanity. We're talking about the insanity of taking a drink for an alcoholic, and I certainly, you know, how could you call it anything else, you know? Whether I had a week, a month, you know, 9 years, for someone like me to pick up a drink is, it's insane, you know? And I, you know, for a long time in AA too, I was, the jaywalker story used to irritate me. I was like, what a, that's overdoing it, folks. Come on. The truth of the matter is, that's what I did. I did that experiment with, and the truck of life was running me over, filled with booze, and you know, where are we going here? There was always the curious mental phenomenon that parallel with our sound reasoning, the sound reasoning not to drink, and you know. The other thing I was thinking, you know, this whole idea of an obsession, you know, I thought an obsession was when you thought about something all the time, like, my obsessions or my idea of an obsession was usually about people, you know, like a girlfriend or something like that, particularly someone that left me, and I just think about them all the time, what happened, but, obsession, as someone else explained to me in AA, it was just a thought that that can crowd out any other thought. So I can have this sound reasoning, you know, that, you know, Brad, look, remember your last drink. That's a good one. and think about the suffering of a week or a month ago. I mean, wow, yeah, that's not a bad idea. Yeah, that's terrible. I did a trial, you know, and then all of a sudden, boy, this party, there's going to be a big party on Friday night. Ooh, that thought crowds out, and I have no access to that sound reasoning, and I end up drinking. And that was my experience time after time, and in a variety of ways. I'm one of the things that you know, and I'm going to kind of get back to Robert was talking about how his friends were talking to him. You know, when he quit drinking for 10 days, they're like, please drink. I had that experience too. I was the woman I was living with, and she was a train wreck. I mean, she was a mess at, you know, after living with me for some time, neurotic and freaked out, always trying to help me, you know, get back on the wagon. And I just remember on several occasions, you know, we'd be out to dinner, and finally she says, "Why don't you just have a beer?" And of course, I was like, "Hey, great idea." And it was painful to be around me. You know, I think, you know, I wasn't screaming or anything like that, but the tension, you know, the edginess, you know, that just the angular energy that I was shooting off of me, just, it couldn't have been enjoyable to be around. I know it wasn't enjoyable for me, and that's why I had to have some relief. And you know, and Robert's kind of mentioned it several times about that sufficient substitute. And you know, and that's AA has been the only sufficient substitute that I've experienced. All those any of my nifty little strategies, plans, and stuff, and some of them had some life for like a week or so, you know, some of them really been there strong, but they inevitably, they just did, it wasn't, it had no sustainability, you know, and this AA, these simple actions, and this being involved, having a sponsor, having a home group, being involved in AA has provided me with that sufficient substitute. You know, and it doesn't matter really what's going on in my life, you know, whether there's chaos or bliss, you know, I've found that I can handle the seas of my life just by doing this stuff, and I forget about this a lot, you know, because it's been a while since I've taken a drink, and I do in some sense take it for granted. This huge gift of being free from alcohol. Alcohol truly was my master, and it wasn't a kind master for the last couple years, and I've been free from that for some time now, and that's huge. So
Thanks, Brad. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say I like this reading. I do, though. In the very beginning, I mentioned there was like two or three songs on my CD or on my radio. And one was Mississippi by Bob Dylan. I named my brain Mississippi. I'd say the song's definitely worth a listen to. I stayed in Mississippi way too long. That's how it starts out. And that's exactly what I did. I stayed in my brain way too long. It's like a bad neighborhood. You might have heard this. Bad neighborhood. Don't go in it alone. How could it... next day, we would ask ourselves in all earnestness and sincerity, how could this happen? I'm dying here. The best ideas that I got, I'm really, like Brad was saying, I'm really trying. I'm doing the best I can. And that's just failing in every sense. And I like what you said. I thought we had some pretty good ideas. And they were solid for a week, maybe, if I'm lucky. But then they made me into other ideas, which weren't so good. And I'm sorry, piggybacking on that last thing, the last reading coupled with this one, because it kind of all flows. It's to leave it alone, the utter inability to leave it alone. When I first picked my first sponsor, I hung around a little bit, listened to what people had to say. This guy was wildly different than me. We didn't have much in common face value-wise. But as I listened to him, as he shared, I thought he was sincere and he was full of integrity, which is something I wanted. I wanted to be that man. So I go ahead and ask him for some help. And automatically, before listening, I'm dictating. So I'm like, hey, man, I'll do whatever you want. I'll quit my job. I'll go ahead and take medicine that's prescribed by a doctor as it's prescribed. That'll be a new one. I'll go ahead, and I got a fear list, and one of them's being locked up. I'm just way too pretty to go to any place for a very long time. I'm a small guy. I said, I'll assign myself to asylum if you need me to do that. What do you need me to do? I remember this as it was yesterday. And he said, well, let's not do any of that right now. Some of that might have to happen. I don't know. I'm not God. He said that. I was like, good. I'm glad that he's not going to be a dictator or a God. That's good. I already got a higher power. She's about 5'4". He said, don't do any of that. Just don't drink. Call me, and we'll go ahead and start this program. And it's worked for a lot of people for a lot of years. At that time, it was 75 years old, I think. So I stopped thinking so much. I started listening, and I started to apply what I was listening to, which is huge. Self-knowledge. You know, great. I can teach my 3-year-old niece how, well, she's learning to read, but she can follow a good story with butterflies and My Little Pony, so I'm pretty sure she can handle the big book, right? She can memorize things, and I can show her that. But if she or me has the inability to go ahead and apply it in my life, then it's all theoretical. Deeds, not words. One of the things is, and I think it's, you know, for me, I have the inability to go ahead and differentiate the true from the false. My disease will lie to me. I've had about a total, give or take, about 6 clear burning desires. Now you think, oh, he's off the beam. No, not true. I just got done talking to my sponsor. I did a service position. I'm doing service work outside of AA for people. Like our friend Jim, not a cloud in the sky. I love that part. I joke around a lot with people. Not a cloud in the sky. How's everything going? Mm-hmm. And long story short is I was doing everything that I was supposed to do, but I have alcoholism. It's not a bad thing. I'm not a bad person. I got alcoholism. Sometimes I'll creep up and go ahead and jab me right in the kidneys with a shank. It will do that. But what do I do when that happens? Repetition is very good for somebody with short-term memory loss and an iron will. I keep on doing what needs to be done, and then after I do the best I can do, I've got this higher power, and it will do for me what I can't do for myself. When I had these 6 or 7 burning desires that came on super strong, I was like, what am I? It was very real, and it seemed to last a long time. In reality, it was anywhere between 15 seconds to about a half hour, but it seemed, I was physically, mentally, and spiritually drained after that. But I did what you guys told me to do. I prayed, I called, nobody answered. I called again. Sometimes it's inconvenient to pick up the phone. That was the case on 2 of those things, and that's fine. It's nobody's problem. I prayed to something other than myself and went to bed. I woke up, burning desire gone. So, I don't know. I follow instruction books, and it seems to work out real well. Thanks for the show.
Thanks. This will probably be the last paragraph for the evening. It's on page 41. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time, I had not thought of the consequences at all. I had commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. I now remembered what my alcoholic friends had told me, how they prophesied that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come, I would drink again. They had said that, though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, just that did happen and more. For what I had learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew from that moment that I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. I had never been able to understand people who said that a problem had them hopelessly defeated. I knew then it was a crushing blow.
Yeah, I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not would not help in this strange mental blank spot. You know, obviously, as I've told you, the last couple of years of my drinking were with knowledge of AA, and you know, so that was always kind of floating around in the back of my head. But you know, I knew what my diagnosis was, but I it took me to become that hopelessly defeated, and how that looked for me. I actually got to a place where I just kind of surrendered to alcoholism. It's, you know, probably the last 2 or 3 months of my drinking before that intervention happened, that I was just the fight was gone in me, and I remember this as I was reflecting. My wife at the time actually hid my gun. I remember I just wanted to go look at my pistol, and whatever, for whatever reason, and it wasn't there. And I asked her, I said, "Where's mine?" And she goes, "You know, I took care of it. I don't want you having that thing around." And I just remember thinking, "Wow, am I that bad?" You know. But it was. I was just. I couldn't. I couldn't stay stopped, and I was just kind of surrendered to the disease, alcoholism, and all these, and drinking as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. And at that point, you know, it was every night was about oblivion, was about blotting out my consciousness. You know, I just, you know, I don't know how long this thing's going to go on, but I can't seem to do anything about it. I can't seem to solve the alcoholic riddle. And so I knew that hopelessly defeated, and obviously my wife at that time did too. She recognized something was going extremely dark in me. And it was crushing. My existence that last year and a half was awful. There was no, you know, I had to drink for oblivion. You know, that's what I had to, where alcohol had to take me, because the beer buzz or even the mildly drunk thing just wasn't cutting it. It wasn't slicing through the existential dilemma that I was, you know, going through. So,
thanks for sharing. Mm-hmm. That paragraph right there is pretty much, yeah, that's what happened. Without defense, well, then I'm going to get run over. Just simple fact. It's difficult for me, unfortunately, and I do apologize if I'm not following the format. It's tough for me to go ahead and comment just on one thing without another thing, because everything's a lot of intertwinedness for me. But to stay with just that one paragraph, all I can say is, yeah, that's true. If we skip down to the other little tiny paragraph, then I can add a little bit more to that. But like Brad was saying, The hopelessness is terrible. I have a tattoo on my arm, and it's in Gaelic, and it means hope. I've got a few tattoos all over my body, and they're mostly all in Gaelic, and they all recovery-related. If you said it looked in English, I'd look like Rainbow Bright. The hopelessness of it, and the consequences and everything like that. Being lonely, it says in our literature, we're tortured by loneliness. And I was with my real quick story, and then I'll be done. I was with my nephew, who I mentioned before, there's a pecking order in my life. I love everybody, but there's an order. He's at the center of that. He's at the number one list, and I was with him. And we were at some sort of little church fair and stuff like that, and I'm with the person that I adore more than anything on this planet. And he was a little kid at the time. He doesn't recall me drinking. I'm very fortunate for that. And as a result of this program, I'm a different person, and he has contrast in his life. A lot of my family does not do this program, and he sees that, and then he also sees the results of living this program through me and because of you and this book, and I'm eternally grateful for that. But staying on point, we're sort of. I'm sitting in this fair, this church fair, with him, and it should be a great day. And there was something that came over me that I've never really consciously was aware of before, and that was the depths of loneliness. And I'm looking around at all these happy people, parents, kids, aunts, uncles, lovers, whatever, it doesn't matter. They seem to be happy, and I should be happy. For all intents and purposes, I'm not. And there was this loneliness that was very scary to me, and I just hugged him closely. And as a three-year-old, very intuitive. He was like, what's wrong? As 3 years old, he could know that there was something wrong with me. And I didn't have an answer for him. I said, nothing. I lied. An alcoholic lying. I said, no, it's good. Let's go get some funnel cake or play a game or whatever like that. And that is, before you guys got a hold of me, that loneliness grew and grew and grew. And that obsession, like Brad was saying, I had to drink to black out. Fun times were over. There was no more romanticizing. I had to blot out my existence. Or, I like what you shared. I think there's a lot of people that saved my life before AA grabbed a hold of me. Hiding weapons from me was a really good idea. I had two major handlers. I call them handlers because I was like a rabbit dog, and I needed a handler. Put me on a chain and watch me, because if you let me off the chain, then I'm off to the races. Just not drinking, but horrible stuff. And you guys gave me a new way to live. Appreciate it. Thanks. Bye.
All right. I'd like to thank Brad and Robert for sharing. Because we're going to pass them. This is the seventh tradition. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential in every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. Are there any AA-related announcements? Yes?
Thanks, Melissa. I'm an alcoholic.
Melissa. Thank you.
Thanks,
sir. All right. Anybody, I'm seeing somebody pointing. I can't see who it is. Okay.
Southern Ice Street, Southern Ice on the beach is a meeting
Catherine.
I don't know what I do.
You're a hundred. All right, so this is the most important part of the night. We really do think that the newcomer is the most important person in the room. Is there anyone in the first 30 days who would like to introduce themselves by their first name so we can get to know you?
Hey, Ben.
Glenn's the most important person in the room. Glenn, there's literature over on the table there. There's a newcomer packet if you need a meeting list or anything. The paper literature is for free. The books are for sale. Just see one of us afterwards. We'd be glad to help you with that. Sponsorship is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have any questions or would like additional information about sponsorship in AA, Stephanie and Evan are going to be up here at the table. So if you have any questions, they'll be up here afterwards and you can ask them. Feel free to talk to them. Also, feel free to come up and thank our speakers for a wonderful night tonight. Reminder, smokers, please use the butt can provided outside and still stay well away from the front of the church because we're not the only ones using the church. Our meetings are audio recorded and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. And we're going to thank the panel once again.
Oh, wow. I'm taking this part of the time over here.
Participated. After we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the stuff discussed tonight at the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at Plaza del Sol on Colonial and 22nd, or around there. If the railroad tracks turn around, it's right beside you. Who's going to read the last two paragraphs of page 164? Melissa.
My name's Melissa, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Melissa.
Against us, and lead us not into temptation, but deliver us